This week on Weather Brains, getting ready for spring tornado season. Hello, I'm David Black on behalf of the Weather Company from Birmingham, Alabama. With us now is J.B. Elliott. Hello, J.B.
Hello, David, and hello, Bill.
Bill Murray, how are you?
I'm great. It's good to be online with you guys tonight.
It's good to have you, too, and I suppose that we should explain.
I've been fighting quite a cold.
You, too? Don't give it to me.
Yeah, I've been fighting it for a week, and it's finally going away, so I'm very happy to feel better tonight.
Okay. I suppose we should explain where James Spann, John Olshue, Jason Simpson, Brian Peters are. Do you guys want to make the announcement about the jail thing, or should we just come up with some other tale? No. Those guys are involved in a program called Storm Alert, and if you're listening to us from within the coverage range of the ABC affiliate in Birmingham, Alabama, you know what Storm Alert is. It's where the weather crew goes on the road and makes presentations in various cities within the coverage area, and the crew is doing one of those Storm Alert presentations on this day as we prepare this podcast, so they are not able to be with us. They're not in jail, really.
And this is the final one they're doing tonight in the Tuscaloosa area at Northport.
That's right. And if you did not have a chance to catch Storm Alert when they were making the various city appearances, you're out of luck. Now, actually, that's not totally true. James has told us that there is going to be a special Storm Alert presentation on the air on ABC 3340 at some point in the future. So you should be able to catch that.
Sometime later in March, yeah.
Right. And Jamie, you've been part of the Storm Alert tours in the past. Those things really pull in some attendance, don't they?
They sure do. Most of them are packed out before the program even starts. And I believe I heard James say a while ago that the Northport Civic Center was already full and could accept no more people as early as 6:15 or so this evening, 45 minutes before it starts.
Just think if they charged admission.
Yes, that would be neat.
Well, that is just amazing. I mean, that shows you how many people are interested in weather.
That's what I was going to say. It tells you what the concern is, I think, is the interest and the concern. And this is the time of year when we start to look ahead to the spring. Now, we're not completely out of winter yet. I suppose the computer models, Bill, could spring a surprise and bring us some more winter precip. But we are starting to look toward springing up and getting a little bit warmer, too.
And we all remember what happened back in March of 1993, too, with our big winter storm that we experienced back then, the superstorm. So
March 14th or something, I think?
Yeah, I think actually March the 12th, wasn't it, JB? Is that right?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
If you look at the GFS and you believe it now, I think that we'll probably have the potential for another cold snap about that same time this year. James mentioned it on the afternoon discussion today.
Mm. You just never know. But then the models might do a flip-flop on the next run, right?
Oh, there's no question.
And be singing a totally different
tune. It could be showing 80 degrees by tomorrow's run, you're right. But I think that is interesting. And it also points out that there's perhaps a severe weather threat right in advance of that cold snap. So
I am very wary of models that far out.
Oh, wow. It's hocus-pocus out that far anyway, you're right.
We've had snow pretty late in the spring season, too, haven't we?
Yeah, boy, I remember an April 8th snow event, JB. I think if you will help me remember the date, but I think it was probably in 1987 that it snowed on April 8th, about 4 inches in Birmingham. I remember going to bed that night, and I think the last word on the NOAA weather radio was temperatures will rise through the night, and I guess probably we had evaporative cooling or something that happened. I woke up about 4 a.m., and it was snowing to beat the band, and there were probably already 2 to 3 inches on the ground.
And I believe it was my voice on the weather radio that night, and we missed that one entirely because we had some cooling from above and some colder air pulled in from the northeast, and it changed over to a big wet snowflakes, and it became known as the Dogwood Snowstorm because dogwood and azaleas were already in bloom, and all the trees had greened up. So the weight of the snow broke off thousands and thousands of tree limbs.
Forecaster's nightmare.
I wish I had a tape of that, JB, because that would have been one of the few times you were wrong on NOAA Weather Radio.
That's right.
In the years that I was listening, that's for sure.
I think we all have memories of JB on Weather Radio, don't we? I sure do.
Harless. I made some unique photographs of that the aftermath of that snowstorm with close-up pictures of the azalea blossoms with snow dangling over the blossoms and dogwood blossoms also. It was very interesting.
I feel sort of gifted, speaking of JB on Weather Radio, Bill. I remember a couple of times listening to JB live on Weather Radio. Did you ever have that happen?
Oh, absolutely.
Not the tape.
JB or Jay Shelley went live on NOAA Weather Radio. Boy,
if you knew something serious was happening.
And I think you brought up last week, David, that you know the voices, the automated voices, are sort of difficult to listen to. And even though the Weather Service has sort of improved them, you know, they're still a long way from being something that you can really listen to. I know that it saves the forecaster's time, and that's important. It gets the warnings out maybe quicker, I don't know. But it seems like to me that it's certainly not as listenable as it was when there were real live voices.
I suppose it sounds corny to say this, but I'll say it anyway. The human element is gone, and I miss that. And I'm not trying to bash the Weather Service. It is technologically a great thing. They can enter in the warning in the computer system, and literally, as quickly as they press enter, it starts going out on Weather Radio. And JB, tell me, before you had to walk into the radio booth and read it, record. Is that right? Was that the way it worked?
Yeah, we did a tape and put it in the sequence. In case of a tornado warning, we would put every other item on skip. Only the station ID would play, and the tornado warning, and maybe a brief tape of some other type, so it wouldn't recycle back around and catch the tornado tape before it had finished running. But basically, we stripped the weather radio of any weather broadcast material except the warnings and maybe some follow-up notes on a progress report on the warnings. And as far as going live is concerned, we didn't get to do that very often, but we did go live during the Smithfield tornado in April 1977 at mid-afternoon, when about 25 or 28 people were killed in the Smithfield section of Birmingham.
I'm assuming that it was always a spring tornado event that would have you going on live, or were there other cases you know of?
I don't remember going live in the autumn tornado season. Back then, spring was king as far as tornado outbreaks was concerned. And you know, in recent years, in the last 5 or 6 years, or is it 7 years, Bill, that the autumn tornado season has been more active than the spring tornado season. But I definitely do not believe that would be a permanent trend. I think in the long haul, we'll go back to where the spring tornado season is king.
Speaking of tornado season, we all have heard the term Tornado Alley, and everybody knows that's various parts of the Central Plains, Oklahoma, up into Kansas, wherever. But Bill Murray, you had an article you posted on the weather blog at abc3340.com just a few days back. I thought it was fascinating, and that really seems to suggest that Tornado Alley isn't the only place where it's really at, so to speak, concerning tornadoes.
Well, that's exactly right. Actually, Alan Gerard at the National Weather Service office over in Jackson, Mississippi, sent it to James and shared it with him, and then he shared it with us. And I was fascinated by this PowerPoint presentation that all of our audience can actually see, too. If you go back and look at our blog, you can get the address there. The researchers, Alan Gerard, John Gagan, and John Gordon, the first two guys are from Jackson, and John Gordon is from the National Weather Service in Louisville. He actually was at the Huntsville National Weather Service before, but they went back and studied, I think, back to 1998, which is a relatively small data set, because we really have accurate tornado statistics back to 1950. They went back and studied it and said, hey, look, you've got, you know, this area called Dixie Alley. A real famous man named Alan Pearson actually coined that phrase when he worked at the National Severe Storms Forecast Center back after the Mississippi Delta outbreak in 1971. He coined that phrase saying, you know, that really, you know, we had another separate secondary tornado alley that extended across, you know, across the Deep South. And they went back and looked at this, and when they pulled the data from the database, they found out that strong and violent tornadoes, really F3 to F5 tornadoes, and killer tornadoes are much more prevalent in this Dixie Alley area. And another thing, down here, the tornado threat is not as seasonal. You know, in the plains, it happens, you know, predominantly from, you know, it kind of migrates from Texas in March and April, moves north into the northern plains as you move toward May and June. But they found out that killer tornadoes and strong to violent tornadoes were much more prevalent, and that a lot of our tornadoes, as we already knew, really occur in the late night hours. So I came across these following conclusions I thought were interesting. There are 1.5 times as many strong tornadoes in our part of the country as opposed to traditional Tornado Alley. That's surprising. That's very important for us to know. And down here, there were 66 killer tornadoes during their sample time versus only 24 in traditional Tornado Alley, going up from, you know, parts of Texas to North Dakota, or I guess really up to about Nebraska. You know, because our tornadoes are more high precipitation storms. They come from high precipitation supercells. They're obscured in terrain, and they're wrapped in rain also, and it makes it harder for us to see it coming. So you add on top of the fact that a lot of ours occur at night, and it makes our tornadoes deadlier. So killer tornadoes are a lot more prevalent here. And we also suffer, they also discovered that we have more outbreaks of tornadoes, defined as events where there were 10 or more strong tornadoes in the region. We had nearly twice as many here.
The secondary tornado season in November and early December is much more pronounced here in the southeast than it is in the Great Plains. In fact, in November, their study indicated nearly three times as many tornadoes in November for the southeast Tornado Alley, and maybe four times as many in December for the southeast Tornado Alley. And by the way, you have to figure in the square miles during those two. The Dixie Tornado Alley comprises of 276,890 square miles, while the Great Plains is 407,000 square miles. So the Great Plains Tornado Alley covers a larger geographical area, but the population in the Great Plains Tornado Alley is 17,824,000, whereas in the Southeast Alley, it's 24,948,000. So that often leads, of course, to more fatalities here in the Southeast because of the population density.
So per capita, we have a higher density is what you're saying.
Yes.
And let me ask something else here to make sure I'm straight on this. Bill, we're not talking about the number of tornadoes, but what you're saying from that study is that of the tornadoes that happen, we have more that are more violent.
That's exactly right. They made a big point about the fact that there are still more tornadoes in Tornado Alley overall. During that same time period, there were quite a few more. I don't remember the exact number, but in traditional Tornado Alley, they certainly suffer more. So we're not taking away anything from that area because it obviously gets more tornadoes than anywhere in the world. But it points out the fact that we have to be, you know, even more vigilant here in the southern United States because of the type of tornadoes we deal with.
And being more vigilant means providing more coverage on the broadcast television stations, on the internet, as ABC 3340 does. It amazes me to see severe weather coverage and have viewers complain about it. Does that strike you guys as a little unusual?
Well, it strikes me as totally odd, but I know that there's certain when somebody would rather watch Dancing with the Stars than I might step on some toes here, but you know, then know that there was a killer tornado somewhere in the coverage area, and that kind of blows my mind. But I guess I'm a little biased in that regard, probably.
April 8th, 1998, the Oak Grove, Alabama tornado, which killed 32 people, really was a watershed moment, I think, for the news media in the Birmingham market, because ABC 3340, under James Spann's direction, was covering that entire event live on the air. I don't recall how many hours they stayed on, but they were on the air most of the night, were they not, JB?
That's true, and we were also doing wall-to-wall radio coverage from the ABC 3340 weather office that night, and so it was pretty well covered. And, of course, more people were watching television than were listening to the radio, but there was a broad base of coverage.
And I think that set a real precedent that other news organizations have since started following, and it just reinforces to me the importance of Severe Weather Awareness Week, which was just held recently in Alabama, and is going to be held in coming weeks across other states. It's really a chance, I think, to get serious about knowing whether or not you have the means to be aware of severe weather. You guys ever marvel at people in this day and age of technology who say, it hit without warning. I never heard it. Does that seem
right? That's the book I'm going to write one day, David. It's going to be called Without Warning, because you hear it over and over and over again, and it absolutely drives me crazy.
It's an automatic reaction, even with the news media sometimes.
You know, you hear people say, even, you know, in Punta Gorda, Florida, you know, we didn't have any warning, you know, for a hurricane. You know, they say, well, you know, you read all the time when, like, the Evansville tornado hit, you know, back in January, and a terrible tragedy hit the trailer park. You know, they said, we didn't have any warning. But, you know, the weather service there in, I guess, Evansville or Paducah, wherever it came from, was absolutely on top of that storm. The tornado watches were out well in advance, and then the warnings, you know, were clearly there. And the television media, I went back and saw some of the coverage that was archived on some of the television stations, and it was superior. And, you know, I think we're very lucky here in Alabama, because I would put, you know, literally our network television stations weather coverage up against anybody's in the country, and that's pretty strong. I've gotten to spend a lot of time in Oklahoma City, and I've gotten to watch Gary England on channel, I think it's channel 4 in Oklahoma City, and he is spectacular. His coverage during the May 1999 tornado outbreak that, you know, devastated Oklahoma City is just the stuff that, you know, you look at in textbooks. There's no telling how many hundreds of lives he saved that day. But I think here in Birmingham, you know, I think we're blessed to have the dedication of our network stations to provide severe weather coverage, and I'd put our coverage up against anybody's here, especially 3340, but all the other stations do a good job too.
I don't know what it costs them financially, but you sit there and look at a television station like 3340 staying on the air live for 2, 3, 4 hours, not able to run any commercials during that time for obvious reasons. That's got to be a significant financial impact on them as well, too.
Many, many thousands of dollars.
But it truly is a public service dedication to warning people. Do you guys think that there's more effect in seeing a James Spann on television pointing to a rotating thunderstorm on television, on the radar, more effect with that than just hearing a generic warning on the radio, weather radio broadcast station saying a tornado might be occurring? Seems to be a little different punch there, doesn't it?
Yeah, visuals always happen. Of course, you can only get visuals on television instead of radio, but those, I guess, could be a little bit confusing too, especially all of the bells and whistles that we have now on television stations showing where a tornado is. The big advantage to it, of course, is that James Spann or the other guys on the other stations are there explaining the situation, and that's the key point.
I think it was so funny at the Mississippi State Conference a couple of years ago. You know, they had a guy from the National Weather Association who stood up there, and, you know, he followed James, actually, and I think, or maybe James followed him, and he, you know, wanted to say some of the things you did and didn't do. And some of them were the things that James does do. You know, he said, you know, like, you know, taking your coat off and rolling your sleeves up. But when I see James with those sleeves rolled up and those suspenders, you know, I think that gets Alabamians' attention, just like JB going live did on NOAA Weather Radio many years ago.
Well, it's a serious message for sure when you see that. We got email, by the way, from a listener to a previous podcast kind of touching on broadcast coverage. Argus writes, quote, "Why is severe weather coverage different in some markets as far as long-form coverage? I was in Atlanta in May 1999 when the same storm system that produced the horrible tornado in Oklahoma City came through. Around 9 a.m. that morning, there was a tornado warning for Gwinnett County. The stations cut in for about 2 minutes, and that was it. I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 2000, and there were tornado warnings in their market. Like Atlanta, the cut-ins were brief with no long-form coverage. They are in the heart of Tornado Alley, too, so that surprised me." What do you think of that?
I'm surprised at Tulsa. I would assume they would go all out for long-form coverage, being that close to Oklahoma City and following suit and being competitive. But, of course, I think it just develops in certain markets to where the long-form coverage is tried and is so successful and so well-desired that they continue with it.
And I look at Oak Grove, Alabama, April 1998, 32 people die in a storm that's tearing up the territory just not far from downtown Birmingham. I always think back to that storm. It really would have only had to have been a couple more miles further south, the storm track, and who knows what the death toll would have been. 32, bad enough, but...
Well, you're exactly right, David. We haven't had a tornado that's killed 100 people since the 1950s in the United States. Not one single tornado has killed 100 people. And I think that night we dodged a bullet in Birmingham, because if you drew the track of that tornado on out, it would have come across the northern side of downtown through the communities like Norwood, would have hit the Birmingham airport directly, and then torn through areas like Eastlake and Woodlawn, which have very dense residential populations.
And that's the track again that it was on, that it had stayed straight, right?
So if the tornado had been shifted 10 miles to the east,
exactly,
the death toll could have been could have literally been 1,000 probably.
And besides all of that, if we had not had continuous wall-to-wall coverage that night on 3340 and the other stations, and continuous radio coverage, and of course very timely and well-worded warnings from the National Weather Service at Shelby County Airport, no telling what the death toll would have been. It is impossible to tell how many lives were saved by the timely warnings that night, but it had to be a great number.
That's exactly right, JB. That was a great night of watching the system in action, and still, as David said, 32 people died.
And speaking of awareness for severe weather, specifically tornadoes, the federal government, FEMA, recently granted a batch of money, $114,000, to one county in Alabama, Shelby County, for the installation of 8 new tornado sirens. I guess that's great, but I can't help but wonder, is that the best use of that money? And do you guys, JB, for example, do you have any thoughts about putting tornado sirens in?
Tornado sirens, of course, are useful for people who are outside and do not have a radio handy and are not listening to anything. But I am not a great believer that tornado sirens are that effective overall in letting a large number of people know about a tornado warning. Because, for one thing, with so much traffic noise outside, you cannot hear them very far sometimes. And I just believe that broadcast warnings are by far the best way to go. And the EMA, of course, issuing the warnings to all the schools, or relaying all the warnings to all the schools throughout their county responsibility area, is the quickest way and the most effective way to save lives. Now, I can't play down the sirens entirely, because they certainly can save lives, but you should not be depending on the sirens as your first alarm when a tornado is in the area.
And my point is not to to be critical of this, but I just question how effective that is, because I think about, if you had a weather radio, and that's a $40, depending on the model, we'll call it $40 expenditure, might be a little bit more, might be a little bit less, but $114,000 is a lot of weather radios.
That's like exactly right.
2,800 of them, I think, something like that.
There's no better way to get your weather information than to have a properly set up NOAA weather radio. And I know that a lot of people probably hear this over and over and it falls on deaf ears, but go out to the local retail department store, whatever, and spend $40, like David said. It's just as important as a smoke detector. It is a little challenging, but hey, get some help on how to program it so that you only get the warnings for your county. You can tell it, I only want tornado warnings, or if you live in a flood zone, maybe I'll take a flood warning if it comes, or whatever. But you can tell it, I want these warnings specifically, and I want only this county, or maybe the one county over. And that thing will wake you up in the middle of the night and tell you to turn on the television. And boy, that's that right there, I think, is the biggest potential lifesaver we've got at our fingertips right now.
And if you live in Jefferson County, I strongly recommend also programming Tuscaloosa and Walker County in, because that gives you some lead time.
Exactly, JB.
And if you live in Shelby County, Alabama, maybe Bibb County's not a bad...
Bibb and Tuscaloosa, right.
Right. And like we said earlier, the voice quality is not exactly what we'd like, but I'll tell you what.
It works.
It's going to let you know about it, and the technology now does keep you from being awakened by a flood warning 100 miles away, so it's... A no-brainer to me, speaking of weather brains. But anyway,
absolutely.
Maybe a tornado siren will save somebody's life. I hope it does. But I just can't help but think how many lives might be saved if that money went to weather radios in certain areas anyway.
Well,
hope I haven't stored up a hornet's nest there.
Oh, well.
I don't think you have. I think somebody started a program a few years ago where they raised some funds and presented weather radios to families that couldn't afford them. I think that would be a worthwhile project for any civic organization or any type of organization to take on.
With severe weather season starting to get underway, the tornado season awareness really growing across much of the country, particularly the Southeast, I'm reminded of the fact that you, Bill Murray, have spent some time in the plains doing some storm chasing. That sounds like an entire podcast, if not more than one.
Well, I tell you what, it was something that I really, really wanted to do, and it just, all these years that I've enjoyed the weather, it never occurred to me that I might want to actually chase a tornado. And I took it seriously. I studied it. I went to the National Storm Chasers Convention, and I read a lot, did some good training, with Skywarn training, and got all geared up and went out there, and just it was an amazing experience. People asked me. I called JB on the phone the day that we were on the Harper County, Sumner County, Kansas tornado. And when it first touched down, the first thing I did was dial JB.
And I entered it on the 3340 webpage as he was speaking to me. We kept an update going.
These guys are real-time weather journalists.
I was standing right there about probably at this point a mile away from this this magnificent piece of nature. It was backlit by the sun. It was just, it wasn't, affecting any residential areas. It was just a stunning storm. And, everybody said, were you scared? And I talk to people all the time, when we go this year, why don't you go with me? Or, people that live out there, and they're like, oh, you got to be out of your mind. But, when you know about severe weather, whatever the thing is that you're, that you're studying or that maybe you're afraid of, when you understand it, it takes the fear out of it.
And you did not sound scared on the phone, Bill, but there was excitement in your voice.
Well, there was excitement. There was no question about that.
Because, well, you knew where to be in relation to the storm, too.
That's exactly right. And we need to keep those same principles in mind, here in Alabama. As a matter of fact, someone wrote me and, talked to me about, this inordinate amount of fear of severe weather that she had, that it took her to the point where she couldn't even pick her children up from school in the afternoon if there were, any kind of warning in the area. So, we sat down and talked about it, and I gave her some things to go and look at on the web and told her how to, approach this from a knowledge-based standpoint. I hope tonight there are a few people that are listening that have not only a fascination of the weather, but a fear maybe that can turn that into, a quest for knowledge that will help them not be scared when severe weather comes, because it needs to be respected. We have to be very respectful of it, but it's not something that should panic us.
We're going to have to get you just to give us a whole program on that. JB, you think we ought to give that to Bill as his homework assignment for a future Weather Brains podcast?
Sure, sure. I know he was also extremely worried about running out of gasoline that day, too.
Yeah, that was interesting. We had given up on the day, and we're about to head back to Oklahoma City when we just decided to follow this one little storm, and it just exploded, and unfortunately we had not positioned ourselves very well geographically or fuel-wise, and we were running on fumes when we got into Wichita that night, because unfortunately the tornado was knocking out all the power ahead of us in each little town that we came to. The gas pumps didn't work, so we had to drive all the way to Wichita before we were able to get gasoline.
Wow. Okay. Guys, we are out of time. This has been a great show. Thank you both for participating.
We're going to have to expand this show to an hour.
We may.
I want to go ahead and petition now that this be an hour-long show.
Well, your stories of chasing in the plains would fill an hour, probably more than that, no sweat. And I know that would be fascinating to people. So that is going to be your homework assignment for a future, soon, future podcast.
Yeah, let's don't forget next week, too, David. I want to talk about the Mississippi coast. I told JB I went down there last week on some business, and I was just literally humbled by what I saw.
Really?
Because the pictures don't do it justice, and this is 6 months after that hurricane hit.
We want to hear about it. We'll aim for that next week, okay?
And I believed I wouldn't see a lot of progress, so I can't wait to tell you.
We can't wait to hear about it. We really can't. That's going to be fun. Guys, thank you for taking part, and we'll have the full crew or thereabouts perhaps back with us next time. Anything else I'm forgetting, leaving out before we need to close out, guys?
One more interesting stat about Hurricane Katrina. Did you guys realize that It is estimated that 15 million cubic yards of debris is still to be removed from the Mississippi Gulf Coast alone, and that's what Bill was pretty much talking about just a few minutes ago, that it still looks like a major disaster area all along the Mississippi coast.
That's unbelievable.
Well, no, the thing that was amazing to me, they probably lost 4,000 hotel rooms on the Mississippi coast, and there are very few that are operating now. But there is a plan that's going to bring the Mississippi Gulf Coast back bigger and better than it ever was before, so I'm very excited about that.
We want to hear about that from you next week, okay?
Great.
Fair enough. If you would like to contact us here at WeatherBrains, here's our email address, and we love to hear from you. The address is question@weatherbrains.com. For Bill Murray and J.B. Elliott, I'm David Black. Thank you for listening to us this time. WeatherBrains is a presentation of The Weather Company out of Birmingham, Alabama. WeatherBrains is copyright 2006, all rights reserved. Thanks for listening. See you next time.